It's the Bo's Nose Show with your host, Jay Bolshevich. You can give Jay a call right now at 646-721-9887. That's 646-721-9887.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the inaugural Bo's Nose Radio Show. And I'm your host, Jay Bozovich. And you might be wondering why Bo's Nose. Well, if you go to the website there, you'll see a profile picture of me, and I think it will be obvious. So who am I? I am the West Lane County Commissioner, and I cover from Junction City in Santa Clara all the way to Florence and Dune City on the coast. As my geographic area of Lane County, there are five county commissioners, and we're elected by district. And our county has about 355,000 citizens. So what is Lane County? Lane County is a home rule county in the state of Oregon. For those of you listening from other areas outside on the internet here on KRBN internet radio, it is a home rule county, which means we have the authority as commissioners to do whatever we need to do to run our county, unless it's been specifically banned or exempted from us being able to do that by the state legislature. So we have pretty broad powers as county commissioners. So you might wonder, you know, who am I personally a little bit? Well, I was born in Washington, D.C., right in the belly of the beast, and I grew up in the Maryland suburbs. Part of the baby boom. I was the middle child of five and eventually got an engineering degree from the University of Maryland and worked for 29 years as a civil engineer. Been married for 33 years to my wife, Elizabeth, and I have no children. And on when I'm not doing politics, like the bicycle, I'm part of that spandex mafia that Lars Larson likes to refer to. Have three standard poodles. I enjoy gardening and cooking. And, just all sorts of interesting things. I'm an avid reader. So politically, who am I? That's a really hard one to describe because a lot of people accuse me of having been members of multiple political parties. And that is the truth. I registered as a Democrat when I turned 18. Of course, in the state of Maryland, if you didn't vote in the Democrat primaries, you didn't vote. It's even more Democratic than Oregon is. But when I moved out here to Oregon, I eventually became a libertarian, which really is my core principles. And I consider myself a small L libertarian. But I did realize that this is a two-party system and ended up registering as a Republican. And just about that time, a lot of libertarians were making that move. And it's because the libertarians found a home in the Republican Party as a big tent party. So that's where I am politically. So what are we going to talk about on this show? We're going to talk about Lane County quite a bit because that's what I do. I'm a Lane County commissioner, and I'm sure that's probably what most people are interested in, what's happening within Lane County. But I'm also willing to talk about Oregon and national politics. I'm willing to talk about, everything from the Independent Party in Oregon to, what's happening up there on Capitol Hill with the new speaker and last night's Republican debate. Although I only watched about 15 minutes of it, it's all I could stand. But we can also talk about everything, that's on your mind. Doesn't matter. We'll talk. That's what this is all about, is your participation. Whether it's, hobbies, books, travel, music, poodles, we can find something to talk about. So let's talk a little bit about the county first, because that's the main reason I'm here, because I also would like this as an opportunity for my constituents to talk to me and let me know their concerns and also, understand, where we are with the county, what we're doing with our policies and why we're doing it. And I guess there's no getting around the current story that's out there in the public, and that's the story that's generated with the Register Guard's article on our restructuring of our pay and salary ranges for our non-represented employees, which has made quite the news. There are other things going on at Lane County right now. We could talk about marijuana regulation. we've got an item coming up in next week's board meeting where we're going to be discussing land use changes to control where you can grow, sell, and manufacture recreational marijuana. But I think I want to talk more about the pay structures, because I think that was a thing, just looking at my Facebook page that's generated a lot, looking at the Register Guard's comment pages that's generated a lot. And it's really what seems to be on the voters' mind, because it does seem a bit of a conflict where this county doesn't seem to have enough revenue to run services at times, yet we're considering pay raises for employees. And it kind of makes people wonder, how can you do that and why are you even thinking of doing it? Well, let's first understand the group of employees we're talking about. When we talk about non-represented employees, who are those people? Those are our employees that are ineligible for membership in a union, or they're employees that have information that a union shouldn't have in some ways, like members of our bargaining team in our human resources department. You kind of can't have union members on a bargaining team. You know, it's a conflict of interest. So it's a managers and supervisors, you know, that have disciplinary and financial oversight of union employees. You know, it's employees handling sensitive information. And it's a lot of employees in our administrative department that are actually managing the entire county. So it's a wide variety of employees. It includes, you know, a administrative assistant that is, you know, working in our HR department. It's a sergeant that's in our sheriff's office. It's our department heads, you know, that are in charge of large departments. So it's a big variance of employees. This group of employees, because they're not represented by unions, are the easiest ones for us to ask to make sacrifices when it comes to budget issues. Because of that, they have not had a significant increase in salary since 2008. They've had 1.5% cost of living adjustment last January. So in the last 7 years, 6.5 years, I guess you probably do it now, they've had 1.5% salary increases as far as their salary ranges go. I shouldn't say salary increases, salary range increases. So that's where they are. So how does that compare to some other groups maybe? And I want to go through a few facts and figures here, which is always kind of death on the radio sometimes, but I just want to throw a few things out there. In that last 6.5 years, the consumer price index for Portland has gone up 13.5%. While their salary ranges have only gone up 1.5%. Social Security cost of living adjustments have been 15.1% over that same period of time. Yes, I know you're not getting one this year, but if you look back to last time these employees got a significant change in their their salary structure, Social Security's gotten 15.1%. Our employees have gotten 1.5%. When you look at some of the unions that they have to supervise, you know, this is where we get into the state of Oregon politics a little bit. There was something called the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Act in the state of Oregon. This sets the rules for how we bargain with our various bargaining units. And it's really difficult to get a contract now as a public employer with a set of employees that are represented like this without having to give them something. Very difficult. We have managed to have years where there were 0% COLAs in our contracts. Most of them have stayed maximum 2%. Sometimes zero. But as you look at these contracts, and these are the people that are being supervised by non-representatives, since in the same 6.5 time period, our AFSCME folks have gotten 8.8%. You look at our AFSCME nurses have gotten 13.5%. Our public Works employees, Local 626, have gotten 9.9%. Our administrative professionals in our Public Works Department have gotten 10.4%. Our Sheriff's Deputies Union has gotten 10.4%. Our parole and probation officers have gotten 9.9%. So it's really difficult when you have the supervisors that haven't gotten the increases where you have the line workers that have. Of course, now none of these unions has done as well as Social Security's done over 6.5 years. But that's just for a little bit of comparison. What happens when this occurs is our non-represented supervisors, the first line up, the sergeants in the sheriff's departments, the first level supervisors for these employees, there are some of those positions that are actually paid less than an experienced line worker. So when you do have a good line worker that's showing potential for management, it makes it very difficult to ask them to take a promotion with less pay. And that's part of the pay inequity that we were trying to fix with restructuring the pay for non-represented employees. So why did we choose to look at the five county comparators? You know, I think if you read the news story in the Guard, we're looking at Washington County, Clackamas County, Marion County, Deschutes County, and Jackson County. And the reason we're doing that is those are the exact five counties that when we go into arbitration with our strike prohibited unions, which we have three unions that are strike prohibited out of the seven that we deal with, the arbitrator looks at those same counties because they're the five closest counties to Lane County in population. Not because their median income's the same as ours, not because the standard of living's close. It's all about population. That's the only thing the arbitrator looks at. So we tried to use the counties, and it does kind of give us a variance. Of course, Washington and Clackamas pay more than we'll ever pay, and we're not trying to get up to their level. But Deschutes, Marion, and Jackson all tend to pay lower amounts than some counties. So, yeah, we'll have our employees arguing we shouldn't be using Jackson County, and we'll have the public arguing we shouldn't be using Washington County. Well, that's definitely we're finding a balance and trying to find ourselves someplace in the middle of those counties. But that's why we chose those five counties. And in fact, our 2013 study we did that we ended up throwing out and just giving the 1.5% COLA actually included the city of Eugene and some local utilities and some private sector employers locally. And those comparisons actually ended up with much higher salary ranges than our current survey of those five counties. So going back to those five counties actually generated lower salary ranges. Now, one of the things I want to mention here is the study actually projected that we should be increasing our directors, which is our top paid, and there are only five of them in Lane County, by 22%. But what we chose to target was only a 14.9% increase because we understood we weren't going to get all the way to market. You know, we realized that we are a timber-dependent county that is having resource problems, but we knew we had to get somewhere. Being over 20% below market is definitely not where you want to be looking for talented people. So I also want to make people understand how much those employees actually make now. You know, the headlines are all about the five directors, and people looked at that top end of the salary range, which would take them 3 years to get to. They're not going to be immediately increased 14.9%. They'll move to the next step and it'll take them 3 years to get there by steps. That non-represented employees group is 191 employees. 176 out of 191 make less than 100,000 a year. 92 out of that 191 make less than $75,000 a year. 19 of those make less than $50,000 a year. as I mentioned, only five are in that top classification that the Register Guard tried to, basically point everybody towards. So really, when you look at what we were talking about, was a salary structure plan for people that are from less than $50,000 all the way up to those folks that are currently topped out at $120,000 plus. And it's about keeping all that in alignment. If you're going to try and fix the low end, which and get those supervisors being paid more than their union charges that they're supervising, you have to do something throughout the whole range, or you end up with again, problems with folks that are in a position of lower responsibility being supervised by somebody that's actually making less money. So everybody has to move somewhat. So one of the things for me that people don't quite get is how valuable are these employees? Really, what do they represent in value to you, the taxpayer? I talked about they're the non-union employees. They have sensitive information. These are the folks that prevent your information from ending up in the hands of, the Russian mafia so they can steal your credit card numbers. These are the folks that handle HIPAA information in our health clinics. They handle very sensitive information, so you really want them not to be careless. But really, what is the value to the taxpayers? These are the innovators and the thinkers and the implementers in Lane County. In a lot of ways, these are the folks I owe a lot of thanks to for saving Lane County millions of dollars over my term as with Lane County Commissioner. When I first came on as a county commissioner, every one of our seven bargaining units had its own set of health insurance plans. And they usually had a couple choices within those plans. Our HR department was managing almost 20 different insurance plans and the claims and the enrollment and everything that went with that. One of the first things our new HR director did in conjunction with our county administrator and with the assistance of all these non-represented staff was to look at how can we take all these different plans and get everybody down to two common plans. One of the plans being a high deductible plan with a true health savings account connected to it that was going to save Lane County lots of money. And how could we incentivize people to move to that cheaper plan? We bargained that with seven bargaining units. We now are on two and only two plans. We're going to be starting a third in January, which we also bargain with for our new employees. That's going to actually avoid the Cadillac healthcare tax for us. Just switching to those two common plans from those multiple plans we had saved us over $2 million a year in administrative costs. So when people start looking at, that's going to cost Lane County more than $800,000 to restructure the pay for these folks, these are the folks that saved us $2 million, not just once, not twice, but every year going forward by helping us get to those two common plans. In addition to that, they're the ones that helped with the whole restructuring of Lane County in my first term. We went from 14 departments in that restructuring down to 9. And ultimately, with a little bit of additional restructuring and some legislative changes, we went down to 8. So at one point, when I first came on here, we had 14 department heads. We're down to 8 department heads. Now, 3 of those department heads are elected, so they actually have their salaries set separately. They're not really part of this group. That's why there's only 5 department heads now that are in that top salary classification. What happened during that restructuring is those remaining department heads took on duties that were previously done by somebody else. Yet that was during the period we had frozen their salaries. So that's the kind of folks we're dealing with, that were willing to restructure, eliminate positions, take on extra duties, yet knowingly without any salary increase. And it wasn't just at the department head level. We folded a lot of positions together during that restructuring. It was when we were trying to get our budget down by, you know, $8 million that year in the general fund. We had to do some pretty drastic things. And it was those employees that were our innovators and the people that implemented that got us to the point where we could make those cost savings. So that's the value those people bring. And that's the reason why you want to have highly skilled, competent folks in the non-represented portion of Lane County. They're the ones that are going to be saving us the money in the long run. So it does look like a lot of money, but that is based on saving people that are saving us millions of dollars a year with innovative thinking. And that's really what I would hope people would look at is, you know, how are those folks actually valued to the community? Are they generating a return on the investment in them? Are they bringing us back more savings than what we're going to spend on trying to have a competitive, and it's not, we're even not getting totally competitive. We're only going about 2/3 of the way to competitive. Are those folks giving us enough value to justify that? And when I looked at the studies, I looked at where we were, I understand who we're trying to keep there and the fact that we've lost people to other organizations for higher pay. You know, I talked about the HR director that helped us get through not only the restructuring of our health insurance down to two plans, but also the restructuring of the entire county, you know, from 14 departments down to 9. She doesn't work for Lane County anymore. She works for the state of Oregon for more money. You know, our assessor left us to go work as an assistant department director in Springfield. We've had employees that have left us to go work for the city of Eugene part-time for almost as much money as they were making full-time with Lane County. So that's really, you know, what we're struggling with is we want to retain good employees. We also want to attract good employees. And it's being very short-sighted to say, oh, you know, we shouldn't spend that money. We ought to spend it over here or, you know, why? Well, we're going to start losing employees pretty significantly. We have employees that are probably getting pretty close to retirement age in some of these key positions. We need to recruit and retain and keep really high quality people in these positions. They're the ones that are going to help us get through the tough times in the future. They're the ones that are going to be the innovators. They're going to be the ones that are going to implement cost savings. And that is why I was supportive of moving forward with the pay restructuring. And I want to make sure everyone's clear. It did not include commissioners. In fact, since I became a commissioner, I actually proposed and we voted on cutting our compensation by 2%. We also voted on cutting our staff immediately. So we have no personal staff as commissioners. We also twice cut our office budgets and cut our contingency fund that the commissioners have available to us. You know, I don't know if you remember, but, you know, 10 years ago or so, the commissioners were using their contingency fund to buy turkeys for dinners and stuff like that. We just don't have that available to us anymore. You know, and we don't have taxpayers' money to use it for our own personal charity choices. That's really, you know, we're not included in this. We've made sacrifices. We understand as elected officials, we are true public servants. We asked for these jobs. We asked you to vote us into office, and we're going to be the ones that will continue to make sacrifices. But I think it's short-sighted not to have management looking at where we want to be in the future, how we're going to save money, and you do that with talented, competent people. So I think I've covered the raise situation kind of from A to Z. I'm not sure if folks have questions out there. Now, I'll just remind you that you can call anytime at 646-721-9887. And if you press 1, if you have a question, then that will get you into the show here. So give us a call. And if you don't want to talk about raises, we can talk about some other things. We got some kind of interesting things coming up on the board next week. We are going to be looking at the city of Cobourg quite closely next week. They're transportation system plan amendments coming before us, as well as their UGB amendment. And this is about how a small city in Lane County is going to grow. And it should be a very interesting discussion and deals with our state land use laws in very interesting ways. Because, you know, one of the things they have to look at is they need to grow on land that's not resource land first, which is agriculturally zoned land or forest land. And they're proposing to actually bring in some agriculturally zoned land. So it'll be an interesting discussion to see how they're justifying bringing that land in before bringing in some what's considered to be exempted lands or impacted that are already being utilized for rural residential, or rural commercial, or rural industrial before the resource lands. So that's going to be a very interesting discussion next week on the city of Coburg. In addition, right after that is when we're going to be starting to talk about marijuana, MJ, wacky weed, pot, that whole stuff. Yeah. And I did go to high school and college in the 70s, and I did inhale. I am not, you know, going to try and pull the wool over anybody's eyes. And I am a libertarian, so I did support legalization. But there are issues about where that stuff should be grown, where it should be sold, and where it should be actually manufactured and produced. And one of the things that the new Measure 91 rules allow for is some local control of time, place, and manner of that. And one of the things we looked at and our staff brought to us is our current land use laws would actually allow marijuana to be produced, packaged, and actually retail sold in rural residential neighborhoods right now. And we need to do something to change that because it's really not a compatible use in a rural residential neighborhood. I think particularly about this time of year, the crop gets rather odoriferous. And I've already gotten a couple complaints about some grows out in my area and from neighbors. And I think we just like to kind of prevent that conflict. One of the things is it doesn't allow for a grow operation in rural industrial right now. And it seems like some of our abandoned mill sites might make wonderful, you know, greenhouse sites out there in rural Lane County, may attract some jobs for rural Lane County. So I'd like to make sure we allow for it to be grown and produced and manufactured and packaged, maybe even sold in rural commercial areas. But we need to update our zoning code a bit on this whole end. So it'll be an interesting discussion there. I know everybody's got their own feelings about marijuana. It is going to add some interesting cost to Lane County. It takes 2 weeks to train a deputy to do DUII recognition for non-alcohol, basically any sort of drugs, to get them certified for that. And then they have to go to annual training to keep it up. And even with that training, it's really hard to get a conviction in court because you don't have a blood test or a breathalyzer test that definitively says you are impaired. It's in the judgment of the trained officer that says you are impaired. And it's an easy thing for a defense attorney to try and pick apart. I cite as my example, I don't think if everyone remembers when there were some U of O football players that got pulled over on I-5 by the state police. And they have video, you know, they had the dash cam video of that. And the windows rolled down on this, heavily tinted glass little, it was a Honda or some other rice burner. The smoke's rolling out of the car and the police officers kind of tilt back away from the windows for a second. And they go, so where's the marijuana? And the response from inside the car was, we smoked it all. And at that time, a friend of mine that is actually gone through that training for a local police force was the officer that got called out to do the DUII test on the driver. Now, mind you, this is a University of Oregon scholarship athlete in their football program a couple years ago. He could not balance on one foot. And so he failed the sobriety test. Yet when that went to court, they were found innocent of DUII. So it's going to be a very interesting thing as we go forward in Lane County to deal with marijuana. But one of the things that we do have control over is where, in rural Lane County at least, it can be grown, sold, and manufactured other than for personal use. We can't change the fact that people have a certain allowance. They can grow a certain amount of plants for personal use in their home, and we're not going to be able to change that. But we can change if somebody's doing a commercial grow in a residential neighborhood, and we can allow for commercial grow operations in rural industrial land. And that's what we'll be looking at next week. So it should be an interesting afternoon next week between Coburg and marijuana. In addition to that, we'll be talking about some upcoming legislation. And in the morning, we're having an interesting discussion with the folks from Trillium about their purchase by Centene. And how that's going to impact Lane County and our healthcare in Lane County. In addition, we're also going to be talking about the Affordable Care Act and the future of the coordinated care organizations and how we get healthcare in Lane County. It's going to be an interesting day because there's some changes coming up in the Affordable Care Act I don't think people are quite aware of, and it's a decrease in the reimbursements to states for care. And budget-wise, it's going to be very difficult for the legislature to deal with that. And I'm kind of curious to see how they deal with that in the budget. So have some interesting things coming up on the board side. We've been looking at some interesting things in the past. You know, one of the things we looked at a couple weeks ago was a land use decision around a religious school out in rural Lane County, which made a news story. The issue wasn't that it was a religious school, and it wasn't even that it was a school at all so much. It was an issue of somebody got a conditional use permit to do a specific use out in a rural piece of property. And did they in fact complete their conditions of their permit on time? And is that use still in force? And whether or not a phased development had to be completed before the 2 years were up, or whether it just had to be put into use and then the use kept continual. The fact that it was a religious school never came up. The fact of who even owned the property never came up. It was all about, you know, the discussion is, you know, the permit, the conditional use permit required that they initiate the use prior to 2 years or ask for an extension. And that there is definitive factual evidence that they had actually taken out building permits and started construction. The second thing is, did they ever abandon the use for longer than a year and give up their conditional use permit? And they have been operating the school on the property continuously since then. Now, they did phase the construction in three phases, and they had not started the third phase. And the folks that were trying to get the permit declared not in force were claiming that because they hadn't started that third phase, that they had failed to initiate within that 2 years or ask for an extension. And that really wasn't, you know, the way the case law and the legal arguments went. It was more about had they initiated the use, not completed construction. And that was the real case before us. Had absolutely nothing to do with whether it was a school or not a school, or whether it just turned out to be a religious school and what religion it was. It really had to do with what was the law around conditional use permits and initiation, and that condition of needing to initiate prior to 2 years, and whether or not the use was continuous and whether the use had been abandoned and therefore was no longer in force. Because one of the things that happened with this particular property is the rules changed around schools in rural areas in the last couple of years. So it's now a non-conforming use. And if they had declared that not to be in force, it probably would have made the school have to relocate. So really interesting. You know, you get into some interesting legal arguments as a county commissioner. Land use is probably the most detailed one to deal with. And sometimes it makes people's eyes go crossed. And in this state, it's unique. And that's, you know, we're getting up to Oregon politics again a little bit. Senate Bill 100, you know, the great, you know, Tom McCall signature piece of legislation other than the bottle bill was going to make this statewide land use planning system. No other state had done it before. Everybody claimed at the time it was going to be the model for the rest of the nation. Everyone else was going to adopt this because it was just such a great thing to have. And we're still the only state with it. you know, after 40 some 50 years. So obviously it wasn't the greatest model in the world. It lends to a hugely bureaucratic system, takes away a lot of local control about decision making with how we grow and how land use happens. It has, though, I have to admit, saved a lot of farm and forest land from development over the time. But in doing so, it's driven up the cost of housing in Oregon to a point where we have our local Eugene mayor asking the governor to, well, I guess she had stopped asking for a declaration of emergency because she realized that cities don't have the authority to ask that, only counties do. But that's our mayor. You know, she has a tendency to reach past her authority at times, sick leave. Really there's a net effect to that. And we've driven up the cost of housing in Oregon artificially because we've constrained the inventory of housing available through our land use laws. So, you know, every action can have unintended consequences. And that's probably, you know, a perfect example of government taking action and having an unintended consequence is our Oregon land use system. So, you know, we've got Coburg coming up here for their land use expansion, their you know, land inventory expansion. And part of their problem is they're going to have some issues there. So it looks like we have a caller here with a question. So we'll go to that call. So what's your name and what's your question?
Hi, my name's Robin. I was just kind of wondering, what did the Lake County Commissioners were saying as far as the gun use laws? I understand that they weren't going to follow the law. Is that my understanding correctly?
I'm glad you asked that question. So let me make clear what we did. We passed a resolution that basically said we were not going to use county resources, i.e. county funding, to enforce Senate Bill 941, which is the expanded background checks. And we have the authority to do that under something called discretionary authority as an elected official. You know, when you have limited resources, which Lane County can't do everything we're mandated to do right now, we're allowed to choose what we want to do as long as we do it based on priorities. And we basically said that that particular law is a low priority. We're not going to use county resources. In addition to that, there's a piece of the Oregon Constitution that actually requires the legislature to fund bills that they pass that cost local governments money. And it's under Article 11, Section 15, and it's called Funding of Programs Imposed Upon Local Governments. And it's referred to as the unfunded mandate section. And basically, they're supposed to fund 95% of the additional cost of expanding a program, and they did not supply any funding for this. So if the legislature, you know, in their short session comes up with some funding for, you know, 941, we will have to enforce it. But right now we have the discretion not to enforce it, and it's under our authority to do so. Because they did not provide funding with the bill, and because we have the ability to choose with limited funds what we do with those funds based on priorities we've set. So that's kind of where we are with that.
So how would that differ than the gun control laws that we have on the books already? How would that make it even better?
How would Senate Bill 941 make it better? I would argue that it won't. And I actually testified or supplied written testimony to amend this bill to make it, I hope, better. There is a small piece of this bill that Lane County had actually lobbied for several years ago, and it was the portion about mental health and being able to get on a voluntary registry or through a court order or family member be put on a registry to be denied a purchase of a firearm. And that was the Chris Kilcullen bill, and we put it forward several years ago. Every time it got into committee, they'd add a whole bunch of other gun control stuff to it, and it would die. And it got put into this bill a little bit, and it's kind of what Floyd justifies the emergency clause around. But my point to them was this should have been that portion of the bill should have been a separate bill passed alone and could have had an emergency clause on it if they wanted it to. But some of this 941 had some pieces in it that just are virtually unenforceable. I don't know how you enforce, a couple guys out in the country decide to, to trade guns or purchase a gun. We find out that they had transferred the gun, sometime because it got stolen from the new owner and got used in a crime, traced back somehow or another to the old owner. He said, I transferred that to so-and-so, but it was prior to the date of the bill was active. Now, how do we know whether it was prior to the date? So I'm not sure that this bill adds anything to that, to gun safety at all. Other than it adds a lot of problems. I have friends that own a gun store. They had somebody bring a gun in after the bill passed for a background check because he was selling it to somebody as a private party. Well, as they had the gun in their possession and checked the new person, he decided not to buy the gun. Now the question is do they have to do a background check on the person they're giving it back to? Well, they did, and he wasn't allowed to have the gun.
Oh, my God.
So now what do you do with the gun? The fact that you have to go into a gun shop to do these background checks, when you turn it over to the gun shop owner, you're making a transfer.
Right.
So now it's in possession of the gun shop who has a federal firearms license. That's why they have a gun shop. Usually they have to go through much more rigorous background check than we ever have to go through to purchase a firearm as a citizen. So they have a much more higher standard when they get handed a weapon, a firearm of any kind. The complexities that this bill has put forward are immense. They didn't put any funding with it. They threw an emergency clause on it so it couldn't get sent out to the citizens, which is denying the citizens voting rights. And they don't have any sort of positive removal of the database for background checks. There's no guarantee that after 3 years, which is supposedly when the records are going to be destroyed, that they're actually going to be destroyed, that they're not going to live on forever in some state computer somewhere.
Yeah, it never goes away. Was it also Oregon as well, that if you loaned a weapon to somebody for a couple of weeks, you had to go get a permit to loan them the weapon?
That's the way Senate Bill 941 is currently written, unless it's a family member.
Right.
So if I'm going on vacation and I'm a little bit worried because, even if you have a gun safe, if you're going to be out of your house for 2 or 3 weeks at a time because I'm going to Europe or whatever, people, will realize a house is empty. And I've seen houses, in this county emptied out, by a moving van, faux moving vans, and they will unbolt and take a gun safe out and take it out in the woods somewhere and get into it. So, you might want to transfer your guns to somebody else while you're gone that will actually be home and keeping an eye on them. You can't do that unless it's a family member. Now, for me, I'm from the East Coast. I don't have a family member here to transfer a gun to. It's just me and my wife, basically.
Somebody comes and steals your gun safe and that gun's registered to you and it's involved in a crime, aren't you liable for it or responsible?
I will not claim to be an attorney. I didn't sneak in a Holiday Inn last night, I'll leave that to the attorneys. I don't know the extent of the liability role around Senate Bill 941, if it extended that liability or not. That's a good question, whether or not that would be an illegal transfer you'd be responsible for. I would hope not. I would hope not, because it wasn't a voluntary transfer. It was an involuntary transfer. But, Senate Bill 941 had a lot of problems and holes and actually created many more problems in the system than it was trying to cure. So I really, wish that it hadn't passed in its form, and if it was going to pass, that they had amended it but we have some of our local Lane County legislators to thank for that bill. And Senator Floyd Prozanski is probably, you know, was the leader on that, completely ignored the input I had on the bill. In fact, he ignored me on the day I came up to testify, even though I was the chair of the Board of Commissioners, and I also live in his district at the time I came up to testify. So interesting, but, you know, we'll have to deal with that down the road. I think my guess is it's going to have to be amended. I mean, they tried to amend it towards the end of the session, but the bill that was going to amend it got killed for various political reasons. It was a bad bill, and it's not making people any safer. In fact, it's probably putting people at risk as they have to now drive miles to their nearest gun shop that can do a background check. And you know, every time you're transporting firearms and handling firearms, there's always an opportunity for somebody to mishandle it. Hopefully folks are dealing with them safely, though. Taking my NRA safety classes personally. So anything else about the Senate Bill 941?
No, I think it's one of those feel-good bills that laws you pass,
but you guys
don't care.
Yep, I agree. You know, the criminals aren't going to pay attention to it, and that's not the way they usually get a hold of weapons anyway. They're mostly stolen and then moving around the criminal black market. It's kind of like, you know, we were talking about marijuana a little bit earlier. It's been federally and state illegal for how long and how available was it? Prohibition never works. Even in countries completely prohibited handguns, there are still handguns on the black market in those countries.
Well, we saw how well gun-free zones worked.
Yeah. Fortunately, in Oregon, though, I will say that the state legislature did one thing right, and they passed a bill that basically said only the legislature has the right to regulate where you can ban concealed carry in public buildings. So that, you know, you can't get the local community college or the local high school principal to say, we're no longer going to allow concealed carry in our building. It has to be a state law to do so. It at least makes it consistent for those folks that are permit holders to know where they can carry and where they can't. Obviously, courthouses are a place that for the most part you can't, and federal property is a place that you can't at this time. But it definitely was something that legislature did well, and it kind of speaks to Oregon's version of the Second Amendment, which is much stronger than even the state's Second Amendment. It doesn't have any pre-qualifying clause about militias. It basically says your right to bear arms shall not be infringed, and is very definitive about it. So I think that's expressed in the legislature's bill that made it statutory that local governments can't regulate concealed carry.
All right. In my opinion, that in an area that guns are totally forbidden, it just makes you more of an easier target.
I would agree, and I'm, you know, working on getting my own concealed carry permit right now. Doing some training with here's your plug Wendigo Tactical with Wendigo Tactical out of Gun Runner Arms. Doing some great work on proper concealed carry, how to work in defensive situations. They got a great range where they set up faux wall panels and everything else, and learning how to do everything from enter a doorway and clear a room to, properly use cover and be safe while you're doing all that, and understanding, you know, where your family is, where everything else is, where your neighbors are, and being responsible if you're going to concealed carry, having that knowledge and practicing it and becoming very competent before you even get your license is really important. Really also recommend that folks take the Utah course, because it does require you to understand some law relative to when you can and can't use a firearm. which, you know, amazes me when I heard that story on the news about this silly woman that pulled her handgun out and shot at a shoplifter as they were leaving Walmart, as they were running away from Walmart. Definitely not legal use of a firearm. So take the classes, become safe, become competent, and practice, then think about, and then understand the law, then think about getting your concealed handgun license. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting is as a population, folks that have concealed handgun permits are lower crime than any other demographic in the United States. And it's just... Yep, you're welcome. So we're getting kind of close to the top of the hour. Hopefully we've stimulated some people. This will go into the archives here shortly after we sign off today. And hopefully folks will get a chance to listen to it and be ready to tune in next Thursday at 4 o'clock. I'm sure there'll be some interesting things to talk about. We can talk more about Lane County raises if you want to talk about that. We might even want to talk about that interesting thing going on out in the Bonita area called the Fern Ridge Community Policing District. That's a really interesting proposal the citizens are bringing forward there to try and resolve some of our issues around public safety and really what I would call the livability crimes, the property crimes being driven by addiction and drug abuse. And it's a really interesting proposal they got there. It's citizen driven. They're looking for a holistic solution from not only just expanded patrol, but to understanding that if you expand the patrol and make the arrest, somebody's got to actually charge and prosecute those folks. There has to be a jail bed to put them in temporarily till they go to court. You might need some money for treatment and for trying to supervise these folks on a work crew and all that. So they've got a very holistic version of what they think public safety needs out there. And they're looking at doing this Fern Ridge district that's going to include Bonita, Albador, Elmira, Notai, Walton, and Crow, and the surrounding rural residential areas and rural areas around that. Interesting concept. The board actually approved having our staff assist them in looking into that concept, and we'll probably be hearing more as the next month or two goes on. But just, you know, one more innovative piece of thinking by even our taxpayers to try and resolve some problems. But of course, it does come with a price. You know, services aren't free, and they're talking about a tax increase with this. So I'm sure that folks will become more and more interested in it as it gets firmed up and they start talking about what the actual tax rate is. Right now, they only have a range of about $1.60 to $1.80 per thousand, which can be a significant amount of money depending on what your property is assessed at. So we can talk about that next week some more. Maybe I might even bring Steve Reister, who's heading up that committee, to come in here and talk with folks also. But I think we should have more to talk about then. We can talk about what we did with marijuana, what happened with the Coburg UGB expansion and their attempt at trying to be ready for future growth and economic activity in the city of Coburg. We can talk about poodles if you'd like. You know, as I mentioned in my Facebook post, I am a standard poodle owner. I think they're the world's greatest dogs. We can argue about who's got the world's greatest dogs or not. But we definitely can talk about poodles, intelligent dogs. I had a veterinarian refer to them as Dobermans with a perm because they are definitely a guard dog also. Very alert, very sensitive, very smart. I also have heard that they have the actual intelligence of an 8-year-old child. And anyone that's dealt with 8-year-olds, they can pretty well train you. And ours have trained us well. You know, they look at us a certain way and we get up and open the door and we're like, why are we letting them out? They look at us another way and we go to bed because we realize it's past our bedtime. You know, they're also creatures of habit and they do kind of run the house, except for maybe the cats that we adopted out of Green Hill and First Avenue. They kind of run the poodles. So it's an interesting household. We also have 10 ducks if you want to talk about kind of the urban farming aspect of doing duck farming for eggs. We can also talk about that a little bit next week. So hopefully we'll be a little bit more entertaining. Maybe I won't spend quite so much time talking about salaries and all that good stuff. And we'll talk a little bit more about maybe national politics and, you know, where I land on Republican candidates, which I can tell you I haven't chosen yet, other than I can tell you who I would not vote for president right now. And you might be surprised who is crossed off my list and who isn't. So we're going to be back on in next week, Thursday at 4 p.m. at Pacific time. And I guess it'll be Pacific Standard Time then. We all get to get an extra hour of sleep this weekend as we roll our clocks back 1 hour on Saturday night. And, you know, who is it that thought of that anyway? I mean, who had the bright idea that sometime in the fall we ought to change our clocks so it's dark when we get home? I don't know. Well, we can talk about that next week too. So, well, that's it for our inaugural show. Thank you for listening, and we will be back next week again, Thursday afternoon, 4 p.m., right here on KRBN Internet Radio. This is the Bo's Nose Show. Talk to you later.